Mr. Eric Curry, the seven.
They like showing us propaganda films, which were mostly Chinese and Russian. Occasionally you'd get one in English, but I can't really recall much of them. But always the cheers would go up when the shooting began. That was, well, one that went down very well. They had a Chinese drama group came round, and I think it went round to all the prisoner of war camps, Chinese actors, and they had an opera called The White Hair Girl, and it lasted 5 or 6 hours. And I'm pretty sure we went to see it twice, and it was something one didn't know about, so off you went to see it, but it was such a damn bore. And they thought they had to explain it to us, you see. They would explain the plot first in Chinese and then in English. And each time the sort of scene basically changed. Well, it was all about a wicked landlord who demanded the peasant's daughter in payment of rent. And being in opera, he used to sing, "I want my rent." And Jack would say, "I haven't got the rent," wailed the peasant. "And then I must have your daughter," sang the landlord. We were encouraged to sing the words, so we made up our own version. "You can't have your so-and-so rent. We're having his daughter first, and after us, you're first." All that sort of thing. And they thought it was marvellous, because we were, you know, sort of joining in with the opera, but they didn't know what we were singing. I suppose with all the hullabaloo going on, they wouldn't know, sort of. But, that went on and on. It lasted, I'm sure, you know, 5 or 6 hours at a time. And it would be freezing cold there, and you'd just got to sit through and watch it. They had the food store where we used to take the rations up to in the early days. They changed that into a sort of games room, come small theatre. But later on, we built a big one. When I say big, I think it sat about 350. Each company would go up on a particular day and take so many rocks and sort of build the walls up, and then the Koreans, Chinese, I'm not quite sure who, would plaster it and all that sort of thing. And it came on pretty good. It was covered with mud or clay or whatever you like, and it was whitewashed inside and out. I can't quite remember what the roof was. I wouldn't have thought it was straw. But it had got a stage and footlights and curtains and a prompt box. And Ted Beckerly, he wrote several plays, and the Yanks couldn't understand our English sense of humour. Mind you, I don't think we can understand theirs either. One Christmas they put on Scrooge. I think a lot of these camps had their own, as I say, drama groups, because I've got a picture in a propaganda book, United Nations Prisoners of War in Korea, and there's a little photograph there of Bill Holbert and Doug Reakey. We were both eight hussars in a singing waiter thing or something. We used to go quite regular to that, especially during the winter months. And I think another one Ted Beckerly put on was a running one about a detective or something like that. One summer's day, we were down by the river and we decided to go for a swim. Well, we said it was China across there, and I suppose there was five or six of us. And it looked about 3, 4, 5 miles away. So we said, "Come on, we'll go for a swim to China." And off we went, and I suppose we'd been gone about half an hour. I don't know what we'd done if we'd got into difficulties, because they used to say that it was an old village underneath where it had been flooded. But the guard suddenly realised, he was sitting up there on the top of the hill, we'd gone too far. And he fired a couple of shots over the top of us and started shouting and madly, so we obviously heard and thought, well, there's nothing ever going to come if we go over, we've got to come back, so we turned around and came back. And another time, the same with the chap with the rock and the Luger, nothing ever came of it. We were never hauled up or had to criticise or anything like that. Most of the time, I suppose, especially during the summer, obviously was spent down by the river, sunbathing and swimming. And we did that for months. And in the very early days, I suppose probably for the best probably 18 months, we used to go in the bare. And then one morning on roll call, they told us we'd got to wear our underpants, our shorts, which we used to wear anyway during the summer, you see, because it was so much cooler. Apparently, you'd see them quite regularly. The North Koreans, they'd come from the town side, which they were able to get to the river a bit further round from us, and they were complaining that the Korean women, North Korean women, were embarrassed by the soldiers without anything on. So then we had to put our shorts on and go swimming. And again, one day in the early part, I suppose it must have been perhaps mid-51, we're having our evening meal, and we saw a British prisoner there, and he was shading his eyes and looking out towards the river. And somebody said, "Oh, he's waiting for his boat to come in." And I suppose probably about half an hour after we'd finished our meal, and we get up to do things, and there was this guy in the water, not the one who'd been looking. He'd been looking at it, but hadn't got the sense to call out as to, you know, look as though somebody's in trouble, mates, or anything like that. Boredom, again, being the biggest problem, really. Fred Moore, I think he was an artillery chap, and George Grace, they were muckers, and one evening they decided to walk up and down on the square, purely for exercise, and they just walked up and down, I suppose, 200 or 300 yards or something like that, backwards and forwards, and it went on for several evenings, and they were joined by others in groups of two or three or four, and, you know, you're just talking and that sort of thing. And then the Chinese, they said, "No, you mustn't do that." Well, we said, "Why not?" They said, "You're planning to escape." And this is what they thought it was, but I suppose somebody, you know, explained it all to them, and it got about it. But it went on. It was one of the highlights of the day, or the evening, if you like, to walk up and down on this square. I wouldn't say everybody did it, but lots of them used to, and you'd just talk about general things, your families and the regiment, and Sunday lunch, changing guard at the palace and all the rest of it, how the credits were getting on, and if the generals had got it all wrong again. What back, I suppose, really, perhaps, to medicine again. Not much to say there, perhaps, really. They've got a hospital as such, but these sort of things come back to mind as time progressed during the prison life. Some saying, you know, we'll all be dead in 6 months, and one guy actually did, and he was. Others caught beriberi, and purely through the diet we were on, there was nothing they could do. Some got over it, and some couldn't, but there was nothing. The Chinese had got nothing except their little old tablets. There was a hospital. One of the lads, he'd got his appendix out there, so I suppose that was all right. And Peter Rowley, 8th Hussars, not in Camp 5. He owes his life to a Chinese doctor. I'm not quite sure where he was, but he'd got one shot of penicillin left. And I think Peter had got pneumonia, and he gave him the shot of penicillin, and he's still about now to tell the story. So it wasn't all bad, as a lot of people would make out, sort of thing. I perhaps was lucky in a sense, except for the dysentery. I managed okay. I didn't need a doctor. I had toothache once and went to the hospital. They had a dentist in afterwards, and they gave me 7 injections. I can remember it now, and I could still feel the pain, and he wanted to take the tooth out, so I said no and got up and left. It wasn't long before it came back, and as I said, by that time they'd got a dentist. And I went to him, and after a couple of jabs, the gum was numb, and out came the tooth. But all the chair he had was a old rustic garden chair. There was nothing at all. It worked okay. And then another day, they'd got a needle doctor coming. Here we are. What they are now, this needle doctor. So acupuncture, obviously, and we say, "Hey, bloomin' witch doctor, I'm not going to see him." But of course, if you haven't got anything else, you'll try anything. And several of them went. I can't remember what they had, but obviously their pain was bad enough to go, and they had the acupuncture, and it was right. They sort of swore by it. And when one considers even now acupuncture is used in the West, I mean, the Chinese have been using it for 2,500, 3,000 years. You can only think, well, all right, who was right. Another thing that we saw, and this was done by the troops themselves, it was the Puerto Ricans. Whether it's anything to do with their religion or not, I don't know. But they used to circumcise themselves. Now, what they did was that they'd go up on the hill out of view of the guards, and yet at the same time I would feel they could probably be seen if he'd moved the right way. But they had a thick piece of wood shaped like a number 7, and that was sort of pushed into the ground and the top piece of the 7 sticking out. And then they would place the penis against the cross piece and roll the foreskin over it, and out come a razor blade, and they just cut it off like that. And they bandage it up and off they go. And I've seen that done several times. And I've also seen it done to 2 or 3 Ulster rifles. So, I don't know. It presumably worked. I didn't hear of anybody having any after effects. I think the Puerto Ricans used to put mud on it, but, I mean, at the same time, you'd think that mud would be have bacteria in it then. So you could pick up something from it. If we had a stubborn cold, you would get colds, even though one was in the open, basically. I suppose it was inevitable, sleeping in close proximity to people. They used to have root ginger in the cookhouse. And if you got onto the POW cooking there for just a little bit, and put that in your tin mug and boil it up and drink it as hot as possible and sweat it out of you. That would cure the cold. It was quite good for it. They didn't issue them to us, but a lot of the Chinese, most of them really, used to wear cotton masks over their nose and mouth. And we used to say it so they didn't catch the germs from the foreign devils. You've got... jumping about a little bit here, our bodies, I suppose, were basically left to us to keep fit, and minds were attended to by the lecturers. And you soon learnt the rantings and ravings of the Chinese teachers to go over our heads, and that was all okay, as long as we agreed with whatever they were going on about, whatever the theme was. And if, for argument's sake, somebody said, well, I don't agree with that, and not necessarily got up, but said to the Chinese, well, so-and-so and so-and-so, they would just go on and on and on, trying to explain to him so as he would see the light. So, I mean, after 2 or 3 sessions like this, we used to say, well, if anybody does that, you'll get sat on, quite literally. I suppose Chinese, their revolution, they were free. It was basically like a dog with 2 tails, really. I mean, they'd started with literally nothing. They destroyed Chiang Kai-shek, hadn't they? Whatever one thinks of the system, it offered the average Chinese a life they'd never dreamed of. And I suppose, again, being thought to be suppressed by the Americans, and if they'd pushed them out of Korea, horrified them. We used to poo-poo a lot of what they told us. But again, who benefited from the war? Only the capitalists and those sort of people. And they used to go on about the peace talks at Panmunjom and that sort of thing, and they were continually being broken off, and it was always the Americans' fault. If it ever came out that the Chinese and North Koreans had broken them off, which they did tell us, I think, on occasions, it was because they were trying to get the best results for the peace-loving peoples of the world sort of thing. You've got lots of rumours about the peace talks and other things, and this again is probably what gave a lot of the chaps the give up itis or just didn't want to carry on anymore. I can't remember when the last prisoner died, but I would think it was probably into the winter of 51-52, because I can still remember some dying, especially the Americans. It was lack, perhaps, of a link with home that happened to a lot of them. I can remember soon after arriving at Camp 5, we were given writing paper and allowed a brief letter home to let them know that we were still alive and how well they were looking after us. And we always used to put a little bull in to help get the letter through. I mean, we knew we were okay, but of course, your mother and father or your wife and children back home, they didn't know how you were. So it didn't matter if you put in a bit of bullshit about how well they were looking after you. Even if it wasn't true, it perhaps would get the letter through and one would know you were alive, sort of thing. I can imagine it must have been a terrible thing to have a knock at the door with the postman and the missing in action telegram, which all the prisoners' relations got after, I think it's 7 days, without any news from the front line. Then the regiment presumably has to notify the authorities that one is missing in action. So, I mean, it's obviously passed down the line. And I think, I know for a fact that when our local postman brought the message round to my parents, he was in tears. I mean, he'd seen me grow up, or basically from since I was about 2 till, well, I suppose 19 when I went to Korea, sort of thing. But they seem to bodge things up, the army. Some people would say typical, but it isn't really. Inasmuch that they'd sent my parents a letter saying that I was missing in action on the 2nd of January. This was about the 20th, I think. And then on the 22nd, they wrote again saying, no, I wasn't missing in action on the 2nd. It was on the 3rd. Well, I mean, surely they could have got it right without having to do that sort of thing. It seems a right mess up, really. It was about, towards the end of April 51, we asked, or the Chinese had asked, if we wanted to make a broadcast message. And several of us did. I was one of them, because I didn't feel it was too much in the way of propaganda from the Chinese. But at the same time, if that message got through, which it did in actually via a radio ham in Australia, it gave my mother and father the news that I was still alive. And I mean, they'd heard nothing at all except that I was missing in action. I think in actual fact they got the first real news, I'm not sure whether it was through this broadcast message or whether it was through the Daily Worker. What one is saying perhaps is that unofficial channels had more information than the British Army. And yet one would have thought they'd have had something. Mail used to come through irregular, I suppose, is the best way. Mine, I was lucky, I suppose. The first one was a great occasion with the Chinese. Everybody had to be on parade and sitting comfortably. We knew what was coming. One seemed to get a gist of some of these things, and there were only about 30. Again, before you get the letters, you have a lecture on how good they were to us, and now we'd been liberated, etc., etc., and receiving their lenient treatment policy. The letters were arrived, and you used to pass them round amongst your mates and that sort of thing. At the very beginning, one did share, but afterwards, perhaps not so much. Sometimes you'd get 3, 4, or 5 at a time, and some didn't get any at all. And then, of course, you've got the other ones where it was a Dear John. We were given paper and pen and ink, which we watered down to make it go further. I don't know quite why one watered it down, but yeah, to make it go further, but perhaps we thought we might not get any more or something. At first, it was just an ordinary sheet of writing paper, and I have heard since that they copied ours, but afterwards it came on a airmail type where one sort of wrote the message inside and put the addresses on the outside and then sealed it all. But one couldn't seal it straight away. You had to leave it open for the censor. There was a case of some being kept behind. I know they didn't all get through, but basically what happened, they had a fire in the Chinese quarters, and some of the POWs had to go up there to help sort of clean it up. Don't know how, it wasn't started deliberately, I'm sure. But what they did find was a lot of half-burnt letters, which should have gone out months earlier, and a big row ensued over that. But the explanation they gave us, well, one accepted it, but I don't know whether one really believed it or not. Christmas time, we used to make cards. They were designed by a commercial artist. Well, he was a commercial artist in Civvy Street, Ronnie Cox, another 8th Hussar, reservist. And they always used to have candles or holly on them with a robin and a couple of birds which he put on with the doves of peace. They were always one for the dove of peace, the Chinese. We did them, copied them and that sort of thing. We always vowed never to buy a Christmas card with a candle on ever again. And Ronnie also designed a Mother's Day card for us to send home with Mother's Day greetings. An Americanism, but we took it up and mine came home, still got it. News, it was very sketchy in the early days, only what they would want to tell us, which wasn't much really. Letters gave us some as they began to come through, and we got a bit, as I say, from the Daily Worker. But the best came from other chaps who'd been taken prisoner. We learned of the Imjin battle. Whilst our camp was mostly from chaps taken January 51, we also had quite a few from the Imjin battle and other subsequent sort of little do's, where you perhaps get two or three bods coming in from the Cosbys, King's Own Scottish Borderers, and other units sort of thing. We had visitors as such. Monica Felton was one. I think she was a member of the British Communist Party or a British peace movement. I think a violent red hair she had. They always put a do on for these type of people. We had Alan Willington and another one come. What was his name?
Wilfred Burchett.
That's right, yeah. Wilfred Burchett, he came round. And they put a do on for these with some of the selected progressive POWs were invited, and they went. I suppose every regime has its favourites. Frank Knoll was another one who came, Associated Press photographer, and he gave the guys some cameras to use, and photographs were taken and sent home. And Albert Spur, he was the one who did another 8th Hussar reservist. He did the Olympics, and he also took a group picture of all the 8th Hussars in Camp 5.
What kind of impression did these Western communists make on you who visited you?
Personally, not much at all. I can't say that they did us any good, but then they didn't do us much harm either. These guys who went to kowtow with them, or have a meal, you know, the selected progressives, they didn't worry us too much, really. I mean, Condren was a chap who was always with the Chinese. He was elected by the British prisoners to be our spokesman, presumably others, because, I mean, it was democratically done, if that's the right word, the communists would think so. One would say, well, where's Condren? Oh, he's hobnobbing with the Chinese. But one never felt any animosity towards Condren, and at the same time, one never felt any animosity towards these chaps who were with these Western visitors, if you like. So, no, it didn't make a lot of difference. I don't know that one got any extra food for it. Camp 5, as I said, was progressive, and it was called a progressive camp. Where or who first gave it the name, I don't know. But we do feel perhaps that it did help us, yet at the same time, we hadn't got anything to start with. Whether it was later on that they decided we were a bit more progressive than the other prisoner of war camps, be they English, American or what, I don't know. No, well, one didn't have too much of anti-opinion on these visitors. We'd heard of the death of the king via our letters, or letters coming in, that is, and I suspect too, probably, from the Chinese authorities themselves. And my mother had sent me a picture of the queen, the new queen as she was then, And we put up a billet in one of the huts, and, you know, they didn't even make us take it down. They let it stay there, which was quite surprising, really. Well, we were rather surprised at that one, because, I mean, obviously, the communists were very anti-royalty. They did have a little session once on bugs. They accused the Americans, and they did show us a film of an American pilot who'd been taken prisoner, who confessed to dropping germ warfare. And they came out with this picture of a capsule, I suppose it was about the size of a fuel tank, on, you know, the extra fuel tanks they put on planes to get them going a bit further. And it was on the ground, and there were these bugs around it. Well, I mean, it can easily be doctored up, sort of thing. But the American aggressors had dropped it, etc., etc. And there you are. There was another little story of the American pilot who's supposed to have flown over the camp. It's quite a laugh, this one. And he signalled in Morse code with his exhaust, "Don't worry, guys, we know you're there." I don't know. We were all right, but whether there were any POW camps that were shot up by the Americans, I mean, it could have happened. We always said they were very trigger-happy. And during the summer, we could see them having their dogfights up in the sky. I mean, you know, they were way, way up and just silver specks, but they were fighting it out with the MiGs. If anything had happened that it had dropped on the camp, no doubt the Chinese would have enlarged on it, of course. I mean, naturally they would.
But that was obviously just a story about the American pilot with the Morse.
Oh, yes, yes, somebody just put it out. But the daily routine, it went on day after day and that sort of thing. The notebooks that we were supposed to put our lecture notes in were used for names and addresses, and they promised faithfully to keep in touch. A few did, but majority didn't, I suppose. In the end, we're in touch with a few of us. Tempers, on the whole, were kept under control. A few times they boil over, but, I mean, one gets that whatever environment you're in, usually over the little trivial things. I suppose, really, after a while, we began to realise that what had seemed in 51 to sort of be a bottomless pit, it wasn't so awful after all, really. We'd shared all the misery and the hunger and the bitter cold of the Korean winters and 40 degrees of frost, but very little snow. I can remember one winter it had snowed and they made us sweep up the paths, and then it snowed again the next day and we had to sweep it up again, you know, and you'd have a moan at them about that, but it gave us something.